I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Dr. George Vredevelt. He's the professor of economics and the director for research at the Economics Center at University of Cincinnati. It feels like things are getting better. What's it feel like in your world?
They're getting better, but it's a slow, slow trek. It seems to be a slow trek up a mighty big hill. But we are seeing more consistently good economic signs, positive signs.
What do you think, though, about the jobs number last month? I mean, it was pretty dismal.
The jobs number was a bit of a setback, but we had 3 or 4 months of consistently good job reports. I'm going to say 1 month does not a trend make. 2 months does not a trend make, but 3 months might make a trend. So I'm not putting too much emphasis on one bad turn, but I always feel that if we can put 3-4 good months together, that shows some systemic strength.
Well, certainly, this being an election year in the United States, I'm sure a lot of emphasis is going to be put on the economy as the general election takes place. But there have been some other elections in Europe that may have an impact on our economy as well. What do you think of the recent elections in Europe?
It's going to change the nature of the game. The election that we had in Greece was essentially inconclusive. The front runners couldn't put a government together, and I'd be really surprised if the next person on board can put a government together. So they're likely to have another election in June, and to see if they can't find enough people to put a government together that is with popular support. But that's a very, very difficult situation. In France, we had a situation where France and Germany reached some agreement on what financial policy should be in Europe, especially with respect to some of the states that have run huge deficits and accumulated big debts. And now with the socialists winning that election, it's really a big question mark as to what the role of France will be in this and whether, in fact, there will be a ruling majority.
Well, it seems like socialism must not extend beyond the national borders in France, right? Because part of what they're saying is they don't want to contribute to the support of Greece and Spain.
That's absolutely true. And I think that many of the Europeans are losing an appetite for contributing to Spain and to Greece.
So how does that impact us here at home, though, George, here in the United States?
I think Europe's in a whole lot of trouble. I think they've got some problems with the system. And it looks like they're heading in to a recession right now. And how does that affect us? Well, first of all, there are trading partners. There are very big trading partners. And if Europe has a slow economy, the demand for our exports to Europe are naturally going to tail off. The bigger concern are the financial concerns within Europe. That is the financial stability of their banks, the financial stability of their businesses. And remember that we are very much partners with Europe. Many of the businesses in Europe are owned in large part by Americans, or they have a big interest in the other direction as well. So we're financially very much intertwined. And bad news for them is also going to spell bad news for us, maybe not as intensely, but it's still not good news.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Dr. George Vredevelt. George is the professor of economics at the University of Cincinnati, and he is currently the director of research for the Center for Economic Education and Research at UC. But now you actually get to go and you're going to teach economics to students. And I don't think I really cared for my economics 101 class in college.
We haven't been called the dismal science for nothing. Actually, it was dismal science because its predictions were dismal according to Malthus and his theories. But most of the student thinks it's dismal because it's sort of dark and dreary and not very interesting at all. Personally, I think that economics is fascinating. And I love economics. And I love to tell the story of economics. To be able to go back and teach students, undergraduate students and graduate students too, but especially undergraduate students, to tell them the story of economics and how it affects lives and how the logic really makes so much sense and how it helps you make better choices. That's a pretty exciting thing for me.
Do you see that younger people these days are starting to see the relevance and why economics is so important as a part of overall education?
At certain universities, economics is a very, very popular course. And for a long time, I've been told at Harvard College, it's the most popular course just tracks thousands and thousands of students. I think that economics teachers have gotten better. I think that we found a way to do a better job of telling the story, because the subject matter is really no different now than it was 20 years ago.
Well, and I can understand why people would be interested, because in its very basic, it's how you make money for a lot of people. Isn't that what economics is?
And it's just in line. I mean, I know you're so passionate about financial education for children, and it's so woven into the overall economic fabric of money.
It's the fabric of life, really. Not only making money, but making wise decisions. And when you talk about financial education, it's your use of money, and it's your stewardship of financial assets that you have, which is important for you personally, but it can be important for your family, make a tremendous difference.
Well, and do you think that because of the economic recession that we've experienced and our children and the young students have seen, that all of a sudden younger people will realize that, you know, there is this thing called money, and you know what, even though you may not need to worship it, it's important to get what you need to get done in life.
I think that's absolutely true. And also what the recession taught us is that other people's bad financial decisions can impact all of us.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. Well, George, thank you so much for being our guest. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, I want to talk today about a program that can help many Ohioans who may be a little delinquent in paying some of their Ohio income taxes.
Well, and that's the amnesty program that was recently announced by the state of Ohio. And really, Ohio's not alone in this. Over half the states in the country have had amnesty programs in the last several years. And the purpose for these programs is to entice taxpayers to come clean and pay their old taxes, file their tax returns that they haven't filed. And the enticement is generally that they get reduced interest and penalties.
It's really a win-win for everyone. So in addition to the taxpayer who may be delinquent or just hasn't filed, or maybe he's made an error and they don't want to go back and fess up, the state is set to obtain millions of dollars in unpaid revenue that they may never have be able to get their hands on otherwise.
Ohio's program lasts about 6 weeks, and they've estimated that between the state and the school districts, they're going to get approximately $40 million of revenues that they wouldn't otherwise receive.
And you mentioned the six-week window. It is a very short period of time. You have it only until June 15th to be able to take advantage. It started on May the 1st, but it covers most every type of tax in the state of Ohio other than consumer use tax. The sales tax is included in this general amnesty program that ends in June.
And very briefly, the benefit of doing this, the penalty that you would otherwise incur for paying your taxes late or filing your tax returns late can be as much as 50% of the tax. And you also save half the interest. So you can save a substantial amount if you go ahead, apply under this amnesty program, and pay your back taxes. It's important that you do have to pay the taxes, though.
You do. You actually have to pay the full balance due under this general amnesty program by June the 15th. The issue there is also that you do not get any kind of payment plan. They want the money immediately in order to qualify for the penalty and interest, half the interest abatement.
You mentioned this includes just about every tax except the consumer use tax. And the reason for that is there's a separate program that's much longer lasting for the use tax. And this use tax is really a problem, again, not just for Ohio, but for all states, primarily because so many people purchase so many items now via the internet. And if you're an Ohio resident and you purchase something from an online source that doesn't do business in Ohio, they're not required to charge you sales tax. However, you are supposed to be paying use tax on that item that you purchased. And most individuals don't even think about that, much less do it.
And you actually include that use tax on your personal income tax return in the state of Ohio. And as you mentioned, most people just look over that line or they don't even know what it means. The fact is, though, that even for businesses, the use tax rules are so complicated that many people, even if they want to do it correctly, they don't understand what is and is not subject to this use tax. So this is another way for the state not only to gain revenue, but also to let some of the business owners off the hook in terms of minimizing the amount of tax they'd have to pay if they come clean. Now, here's the catch for both the consumer use tax, which actually goes until May of 2013, and this new general amnesty program. The issue is that if you're already under audit, or if you've already gotten some kind of notification or assessment from the state, you are not eligible. This is only for unpaid taxes that you've yet to pay. So if you would like more information about this program, you can go to the Ohio website. The website is www.ohiotaxamnesty.gov. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Well, Tom, summer vacation is right around the corner. Children will be getting out of school soon. And, you know, this is just a fabulous opportunity to teach your child the correlation between having a summer job, earning money, and saving money. Work and money go together hand in hand.
Well, and depending on the job they have and the age of the children, you may also teach them a little bit about the tax system if they get their first paycheck and find out that they didn't get paid all the money that they thought they were going to because of the tax withholdings.
I just think it's a great opportunity to teach a child about work ethic. Actually, get engaged with them. Help them brainstorm some ideas of ways that they can actually work and make money. And then have a more lengthy conversation about once you've earned the money, what are you going to do with it? Almost have a budget, a plan of how the money is going to be spent and hopefully saved.
Well, the old adage is it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. And that's certainly true with regard to summer jobs. I mean, you don't want your children to work hard all summer and then at the end of the summer have nothing to show for it except, you know, a really good list of music that they've bought.
And if you actually help them establish goals, short-term goals, long-term goals, I mean, it's not much fun to work and not be able to spend anything. So if you can determine some percentage of money that they're going to be able to spend and save, then that makes that whole conversation easier. And it lets them see some fruits of their labor.
Yeah, and it's even better if they help you determine what that percentage should be. You have to guide them, but convince them that they may even want to save money, even if they're going to buy something with it later, but at least they're saving towards a longer-term goal and not for an immediate entertainment goal.
And even if they're too young to work, per se, I mean, you can encourage them to save some portion of other money that they get, birthday money, allowances. And a good rule of thumb is maybe 10% of what they get in birthday money or allowances to actually save. Help them find an investment vehicle where they can be involved in making a decision about how to invest it and where they can get statements on occasion to show how their money's growing. The fundamental issue here is it's just not as much fun to save as it is to spend. So if you can attach an incentive to the saving, that makes it even more worthwhile. For example, our daughter Ellie, when she was younger, we encouraged her to have a part-time job, and to the extent that she would work, we would match a portion of what she earned, but our dollars that we gave her, the matching portion, went into a Roth IRA, very similar to the 401k concept. And so she thought it was pretty cool that she could work and then we'd give her money for savings.
That's a great thing to do. And Roth IRAs are great for younger kids because they're not paying taxes usually on their earnings. So there's no cost to putting the money in, no foregone tax deduction. But yet when they're 40, 50, 60 years from now, when they take that money out, it will grow many times.
It's just a huge gift. And if you have a business, and if you're unincorporated in that business, it's even better because you can pay a child under the age of 18 money for work. They can make a certain amount of money, several thousands of dollars, and not have to pay any tax on it. You can deduct it as a part of your business expense, and they don't even have to pay self-employment tax on it. So it's a real win-win for both the family, business owner, and the child.
Yeah, and it's a great example for your kids, too, to get them started working at an early age.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Mark Extrakamp. Mark is the Executive Vice President of the Bank in Kentucky. And Mark, congratulations. I know you've had a long presence in this community for several years, had lots of branches on the Kentucky side of the Ohio River, but you've recently opened up a branch downtown.
Yes, we opened at 4th and Walnut, and our official opening date was January 19th. We were very excited. You know, we reached 20 years, and we've always operated in Northern Kentucky. So our first branch was 4th and Walnut.
Is the opening of a branch in Ohio and really an expansion into Ohio, is that a sign that you've emerged from the recession really in a pretty good, strong position in this area?
I think so. You're already seeing larger institutions, larger banks shrink their branches. They're closing offices. I think we've set ourselves up for when the financial crisis hit. We didn't have that situation. We expanded not only to downtown Cincinnati by making a new branch, but we also went into Pendleton County, which was a new market when we acquired United Kentucky Bank. We entered a new county, entered Cincinnati, entered Ohio, and I think it is a real good sign that we've had capital and the things in place where we can make that step.
Well, having said that, Mark, we hear a lot of other businesses talk about the unavailability of capital, that it's very difficult for banks to open up their vaults and make loans. How are you seeing those types of things now? Are you seeing an uptick in that activity?
It is slow but steady in a positive direction. And when the crisis hit, of course, credit froze up. Banks closed their doors in many ways. We never stopped lending, but businesses stopped borrowing. We're starting to see over the past, I guess, eight to nine months, a year, businesses are sort of coming out and either paying debt off because they've built up reserves, or they're starting to lend, they're starting to borrow and expand. And we think it's going to continue, but it's been really, really slow. It's still very anemic.
Don't you think businesses are still pretty cautious? I mean, it seems like you see businesses that are doing well, maybe even making as much money as they were pre-recession, but they're very hesitant to commit to long-term capital expansion, building expansion, big increases in employment.
You're seeing numbers nationally. They're better, but they're still disappointing. And I think that bleeds into us locally. Businesses, I think they're still hunkered down more so than they're willing to take a risk and borrow and grow and buy a building and hire more people, more equipment, whatever.
And if they are, and they do need loans, a lot of times I think they have this unrealistic expectation of what the terms should be.
And that's going to be difficult even going forward. And we're seeing, we're feeling pressure from examiners, from regulators, where they're coming into the bank in numbers that we haven't seen since the bank started. And they're digging into each loan file, wondering why there aren't guarantors and who they are and how they can secure a loan. Because naturally, they're trying to avert another downturn like we had with credit.
If people would like information about the Bank of Kentucky, though, they can go to what? What's your website?
It is www.bankofky.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Mark Extrakamp. Mark is the Executive Vice President of the Bank of Kentucky. And Mark, we hear a lot from politicians, both federally and state level politicians, saying the problem with the economy, or one of the problems, is that banks aren't lending enough money. And yet bankers tell us, well, we want to lend money. Obviously, that's how we make money. But it's hard to lend money because of all the regulations that you have to comply with. You can't just lend money to every business. What's the rub here? What's right? Is it hard to lend money for you guys?
It's harder to lend money. And I think it is consistent in business lending, commercial lending, and in consumer lending, just getting a mortgage nowadays. You know, how many stories have you heard recently where an individual, a family who 3 years ago, 4 years ago would have gotten a loan in 30 days now can't get an appraisal to come back correctly, and it kills the deal? And a lot of that is regulatory pressure on appraisals and how that whole mortgage process works. There's a lot of those aspects that are with business lending and commercial lending too. We never closed our doors. We continue to lend. We've always lent. We want to lend. There's not only less businesses out there that want to borrow, but the pressure that we get month to month from examiners on the types of loans that we have done, where they are, who they're to, what the financials look like, make it more difficult for a bank. And some banks have closed their doors to certain types of lending. They may not lend to a certain segment for various reasons that are regulatory driven or compliance driven. banks are being scrutinized more heavily on their concentrations of their risk. And that might close out a business loan here locally when it really has nothing to do with the business.
So do you see that changing? I mean, do you see with the economy improving a bit, do you think banks will relax those rules and start being able to lend a little more freely?
I hope, but considering the couple thousand pages of Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. the thousands of pages, the Consumer Bureau that has 1,000 job openings, all that to us right. seems to be growing. So I hope that it at least becomes more reasonable, because I think you'd talk to a lot of lenders where on the banking side of it, a lot of the regulations are needed and mm-hmm. they're good things at heart. But we're probably still on the side of they're almost too restrictive to a community bank like us that never got into the troubles that a large bank got into.
Well, and the reason why people should be concerned, even if you just have a home mortgage with a bank, the reason why that should be important to everyone, really, I think, is because it makes it more difficult for people to borrow money.
But it does add cost. We have double the size of our compliance department, and we have to do a lot of things that are new to us. But we're still very much in the market to lend to businesses in this area. Yes.
The thing about Bank of Kentucky is all of the people that make the decisions about loans are right here in our region.
Yeah, our niche really is we like to say we can out-product the locals and out-service the nationals. And that is a lot about lending. So whether you need a loan, you need a fee waived, you need mm-hmm. help with an account, we fix it right here in Northern Kentucky. Our loan decisions are in Crestview. Our operations centers in Florence, and that helps us a lot with moving with a customer and being more nimble, and I think that's really the key reason why we grow every year.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Vanessa Indrillo-Vreeland, and she is a Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Private Equity at Fifth Third. A few weeks ago, I remember actually talking about the fact that Fifth Third has just launched this brand new early stage direct investment program around your footprint in the various states where your footprint is in early stage companies. Maybe you can talk about that and why that was important for the bank to do.
Historically, the bank and banks in general have been active in investing directly into companies. And we've done that historically as well, but have recently seen an opportunity to expand that program to include more early stage companies. What we have found in the recent past, there have been a number of great incubators that have been funded with both private and public money. For example, here in Cincinnati would be Cincy Tech. If you look throughout the bank's entire retail footprint, we have a number of those types of incubators who have helped seed and start up really interesting companies. Those companies are now looking for their next round of financing. They've got real products, real customers, and there tends to not be a lot of money to support them going forward.
So as you're looking at investments in these early stage companies, are you working with these various incubators and Cincy Tech type organizations?
We are trying to get the word out to all of them within our footprint that we have a program and that we're actively looking for investment opportunities. And we've actually engaged a local firm here called West Capital Advisors, mm-hmm. who has early stage venture expertise, and they have a lot of networks as well. And they've been very valuable to us in terms of their ability to source opportunities.
And you made your first investment, if I understand, in a company here in our region called ThinkFine.
Yeah, we did. We were very excited that our first investment was here in Cincinnati. ThinkFine is a marketing optimization solution, and it's a pretty exciting product, especially as more companies look towards how they spend their dollars and what type of revenue they're going to get from social media spend. This technology can help companies do that.
Pretty much all the new net jobs are going to come from small business here over the next several years. It's critical that there be capital. And for the most part, many banks and financial institutions don't want to lend money to startups. So for Fifth Third to step out of the gate, be one of the first banks in the entire country to make investments in these early stage companies, that's quite a wonderful thing.
It's pretty exciting. We are happy to be able to support the local entrepreneurs throughout our retail footprint. We're very passionate about creating jobs in our market where we are located, and we're hopeful that this will help spawn a lot of economic activity in our region.
How many investments do you anticipate making over the course of this program?
You know, that'll depend on how many attractive opportunities we find. We hope to do about two to four a year. So that would be the pace we would look to accomplish, but we're only going to support good companies as we find them. If you think about Fifth Third's footprint, we're up through Chicago, all of Ohio, northern Michigan, through Pittsburgh, and then kind of down the I-75 corridor through Florida and all the states in between. So,
well, we are out of time today, Vanessa, but if someone listening today would like to learn more about the Early Stage Direct Investment Program or about Fifth Third, what's the website?
www.53.com. Yep.
Thank you so much for being our guest, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Vanessa Indriolo-Vreeland, and Vanessa is the Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Private Equity at Fifth Third. And Vanessa, Fifth Third has recently announced that they're going to, and they have actually already begun investing in early stage companies, which is quite unusual for a very large bank like Fifth Third to do. That's very important, though, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We support a lot of small businesses through our lending lines, but sometimes they're just too new or too little early stage to qualify really for a loan. And so we thought this was a really interesting opportunity to use our balance sheet in a way that banks have always supported companies through investment, but focus a little bit on early stage investing to help augment our program.
The challenging thing I would think about early stage investing is not all those companies are going to be late stage. They're
right.
Not all going to make it successfully. How do you determine what to invest in? What criteria do you look at?
Well, stage is pretty important to us. So when you think about early stage companies, we're not investing in the seed or angel round. So if someone comes to us and they've got a great idea, but it's really just a concept at this point, that's not at a point where we would be looking to invest. Where we're looking to invest is when that concept has actually materialized into a real product and that has some sort of unique market application, and the validity of that product has been proven in the marketplace, and the product's already begun to be commercialized, and there's customers who are actually buying that product. So having some sort of revenue component is an important piece of it because it demonstrates the viability of the product. So that's probably the most important thing that we look for. And then as we continue our due diligence, we also look for, you know, what the capital is going to be used for, how are they going to grow their business, and then ultimately at what point we would be able to exit. So who the likely buyers are of the company once it is at a point where it's ready to be sold.
Are there certain industries that you look for or certain ones that you won't invest in?
We'd like to be pretty opportunistic. We're really looking for anyone who has a great idea and a great product and a unique product. I think medical devices are going to be pretty difficult mm-hmm. for us to get done just because of their approval process. There's just a much longer path to a revenue point. Companies that have a longer path to revenue are probably not going to be the ones that we're going to look at.
You know, banks generally are thought of to make money by making loans, mm-hmm. collecting deposits. What do you think this program is going, what impact will it have on Fifth Third?
Well, hopefully we'll earn a financial return on it, but also it's a unique way for the bank to provide a product to customers who wouldn't normally qualify as a mm-hmm. customer of the bank. So it's a way for us to be a little bit more engaged in the entrepreneurial communities in which we work and live, and to be a much more integral part of the economic vibrancy.
You don't see very many banks at all loaning to early stage companies, and it's very difficult to get that capital.
A lot of the VCs who focus on this space, venture capital groups, are located on the East and West Coast, and getting them to come and invest in the Midwest has been somewhat of a challenge.
And if someone listening would like more information about the types of investments that they may even be able to take advantage of, what's the website?
53.com.
Vanessa Indriolo-Vreeland, thank you so much for being our guest, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Stephanie Kappel. Stephanie is you're the development director for the organization called Partners for Achieving School Success. It's at UC. Previous to that, though, Stephanie, you were the executive director of this organization as well. Let's talk about what Partners for Achieving School Success, otherwise known as PASS, is all about.
Our mission is to support students from low economic situations and low performing schools to really provide, it's an area of social justice, to provide an equal opportunity for all students to achieve academic success. And so we have five programs in the center that intertwine really to achieve that and support kids from kindergarten all the way through college.
And one of your focuses is on kids whose parents didn't go to college. I guess you call them first gen.
That's correct. At the University of Cincinnati, we became very aware of the need for extra support or really providing information about the resources that already exist at the university, particularly for students who come from families where no one else had been or had earned a college degree. And so we started the Gen 1 theme house, Gen 1 for first generation. And what our program coordinator, Judy Mousy, you'll hear her say is, kids just don't know what they don't know. They come to college and within the first quarter of their freshman year sometimes can be so lost and so far behind and not aware of the resources available to them that instead of finding those offices at the first wrong door, they stop and turn away and drop out. And sometimes with debt and no degree, no diploma to help earn the dollars needed to repay that debt.
So part of what you do is help these students, once they get to school, navigate and understand what courses to take, what programs to take advantage of?
All I really do is try to bring in the funding so other people can do those jobs. One of our programs is called the Higher Education Mentoring Initiative. And I can tell you a story about a student, we'll call him Jamie, who comes from a family that was really torn apart by a number of social issues. And Jamie was placed in foster care. And about the time he was 16, just as a very angry child, and going through so many different homes and families, and no foster care family in Hamilton County was available to support him. And so Jamie went into what's called independent living. From there, he actually was fortunate enough during his independent living to be given a HEMI mentor, a Higher Education Mentoring Initiative mentor. And HEMI is a program that was started because the executive director of Hamilton County Job and Family Services reached out to Commissioner Greg Hartman and the University of Cincinnati, Greg Veer, and all of us got involved and started this initiative. Jamie got a mentor, and Jamie is now very successful in a college program.
Steffi, we're out of time today, but if folks would like information about Partners for Achieving School Success, what's your website?
Catchpass.com. You can go to www.cechpass.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Stephanie Kappel. And Stephanie is the Director of Development at UC for their program, Partners for Achieving School Success, also known as PASS. The reason that I guess I am so interested in this is because I know not only is it the right thing to do, but economically, from a regional standpoint, we're much better if we have productive, employed, self-sustaining citizens that live and work here.
Sure. There are a number of research studies that show the economic impact of a college education versus a high school education. And 80% of the inmates in jail right now do not have a college, any education beyond high school. And so when you take the economic impact of that, that we're supporting inmates and that they're not contributing to the tax base and retail sales and homeownership and the other positive things, you see that that's one way that really education pays.
Well, and even if you just look at the people who haven't resorted to crime but are underemployed or unemployed, the statistics say that if you have a college education, your chances of being employed are substantially greater, employed in a job that can provide enough income to support a family.
Absolutely. We, in the center, in the Partner for Achieving School Success Center at the University of Cincinnati, we really believe that education is one way to break the cycle, and that breaking that cycle is so important for our country.
And you've actually started a program there called Gear Up Scores, correct?
That's correct.
And that is all focusing on disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged youth.
GEAR UP stands for Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs. It's a federally funded initiative, and our grant was written to support staff in the schools who work directly with the teachers, either team teaching or even pull-out programs or even teaching the classes themselves. We've hired GEAR UP specialists, academic specialists, dropout prevention specialists, college access specialists, and a parent involvement specialist.
To go into the schools?
Mm-hmm. And work with students right in the schools.
And, you know, I didn't mention this in your introduction, but you're actually a doctor at UC, a doctor of education. And the interesting thing in knowing you a little is that you didn't start out with the whole idea of education in your future, did you?
I didn't. In fact, and I believe everyone has a story. Mine is that girls weren't supposed to get an education. I grew up here in Cincinnati, in Delhi, in fact.
And you're not that old.
I'm not that old. Thank you. But if you ask people my age where they went to school, they'll typically tell you their high school, because the theme here wasn't to go to college, and mm-hmm. especially not for girls. So I did what I was told and got married, had two children, but unfortunately their dad died when they were just one and two. And so my resource was what I could mm-hmm. do, and I was scrubbing floors. I knew the university existed, though, mm-hmm. because I had been there as a fourth grader.
And if folks listening today would like to get involved, maybe make a contribution, volunteer, what's the website?
The website is catchpass.com.
Dr. Stephanie Kappel, thank you so much for being my guest. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.